All right, good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. Good to see everyone. We are, as usual, going to ask members to mute your feeds, use the raise your hand function if you'd like to be recognized, and the staff will put it down for you. I've been notified that we do have a quorum, but we're going to ask Ms. Niedernhofer to call the roll and just please answer present when your name is called. Ms. Niedernhofer.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt. Schumacher. Eklund.
Present.
Becker.
Present.
Bonner. Bierman.
Present.
Bolden.
Present.
Damuth.
Present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grunhagen.
Present.
Peel.
Present.
Morrison.
Present.
Cheryl, I'm just.
Munson.
Mute here.
Munson. Pryor.
Here, present.
And I'll go back through the list one more time. Hewitt. Schumacher, Bonner, and Munson.
And Representative Hewitt is here. We just can't hear him for some reason, but he is present.
And Representative Walgamott is here as well, even though my name is not called.
And Representative Schultz is here as well, present.
I didn't finish the list.
Oh,
and Representative Pryor.
Pryor, Quam.
Quam, present.
Ryer.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
And Wolgamott.
Present.
Sorry for that.
Okay, a quorum is present. Were there any other names that needed to be recalled?
This is Representative Bonner. I'm here as well.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bonner. Okay. Very good. All right. We're going to go to Representative Ryer. For a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved. I move we approve the minutes.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. Is there any discussion? These are the minutes of January 19th, yesterday. Seeing no discussion, if you would just unmute yourselves, this is a voice vote. All in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Minutes are approved. Thank you very much. Okay, so our business for today is to hear a really important update from the Department of Health on the vaccine distribution, something that I'm sure that all of our constituents are asking us about. I know there's going to be a lot of interest in the topic, and I really appreciate Commissioner Malcolm taking time to be with us today to give us this really important update. So I'm going to turn it over to you, Commissioner. Welcome to the committee. Oh, and we can't hear you. And you're still muted. There we go.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, members. I'm going to cover some material that some of you I know have seen on all legislator briefings, but I don't think everyone has. So my apologies if this is a little repetitive, but in part, but it's complicated enough that it maybe is not a bad thing to hear it a couple of times. But I'll go fairly quickly through the slides and have plenty of time for your questions and discussion. Next slide, please. It really always needs to be said that it's nothing short of amazing that we are here, you know, 1 year after the first case of COVID-19 was discovered in the United States, not even a year since we had the whole genome sequence out of China, and we have two vaccines that have been approved under emergency use authorization. It kind of boggles the mind, really, and it's a wonderful testament to global collaboration and science at its best. So we've got these two vaccines. There are a couple more in the pipeline. We'll talk about that in a minute. But for now, we have Pfizer and Moderna. And they were both just approved a little over a month ago, remarkably, and here we are delivering them and vaccinating healthcare workers, people in long-term care settings, and now moving on to folks 65 with some special focus also on how to begin to get vaccination to childcare workers and educators in K-12 and staff as part of helping to support the ability of schools to get back to in-person learning for younger learners in particular. But just as a reminder, these two vaccines are complicated. They've got some very particular storage and handling requirements, and they ship in predetermined increments, which make it hard to precisely match the number of doses to any given site that wants to do vaccination. So we're a little bit constrained in who actually can handle and deliver these two vaccines. And the others in the pipeline promise to be a little bit more flexible. But Pfizer, for instance, has to be stored at minus 80 degrees Celsius, that way, way colder than a typical freezer. So ultra cold storage. Pfizer only comes in batches of 975 doses. So Pfizer doesn't work well for smaller sites or smaller populations. Both of these two vaccines require two doses to be given. For Pfizer, it's 21 days after the first dose. The second dose needs to be given. Pfizer also is approved for ages 16 and up. Moderna is approved for ages 18 and up. So there's just little differences here. The difference from Pfizer, Moderna can be stored at more normal freezing temperatures, still cold, but does not require the ultra cold storage or dry ice. The other, if you don't have an ultra cold freezer, you can store Pfizer packed in dry ice, but you have to change that dry ice every, I think it's 3 days. And this the handling is really critical. And once these vaccines are thawed, in the case of Pfizer, once it's thawed and reconstituted, it has to be given within 5 hours, or it can be stored in the refrigerator for a couple of more days. But I'm just making the point here that these aren't just easy vaccines necessarily to store and handle correctly. So that in the first waves of vaccination has meant that the distribution system for who's got the vaccine and who's delivering it is a little bit more constrained than it will be in the future. Moderna is spaced out 28 days between the first and second doses. Next slide, please. So what does the state actually do in vaccination? We'll get into in a couple slides of sort of the whole vaccinator ecosystem that we have in Minnesota and that we are building on for COVID vaccines. But what the state health department in particular does is sort of oversee the system, understand where the population is, understand where the vaccinators are and what their capacity is to do the vaccination, and to place orders for the vaccine with the federal government, and then to support providers, assure the training and so forth, to make sure that the vaccine can be safely administered in Minnesota. But the state is not receiving the vaccine and then redistributing it to providers. We are placing the orders, and the orders are going directly out into the distribution system, which I'll explain in a minute. Next slide, please. So you've probably seen this slide in other forums, but we've known for a long time that we would be in a situation where there'd be some period of time where the supply of vaccine would be much more limited than the total population that should be vaccinated or the demand for vaccination. And what we don't know is how quickly and how far that line is going to ramp up. There's been a lot of confusion just in the last week about how much supply exists and where it is and whether it can be accelerated or not. We will be learning more as the new administration gets now into the process of figuring out what, to the extent that all, that there may be more doses that are available to be purchased from Pfizer or Moderna, how much that is and how it can be distributed most quickly to the states. But as we learned last week, the thought that there were a bunch of doses held in reserve turned out not to be the case. Now, Pfizer does continue to say they have more available if the state, if the federal government wants to purchase it. So that we'll see what, you know, kind of what happens there. Hopefully that situation will get clarified. But at the present time, we are receiving only between 60 and 70,000 doses a week. And that's been true for the last 4 weeks or so, about 30 to 35,000 each for Pfizer and Moderna. So there's a fairly limited supply coming into the state each week. So we're still in that period of time when it's a limited supply, and we're, so that the federal strategy had been to say we should be with that limited supply, set some pretty clear priority populations or phases where you'd be immunizing, you know, the people most at risk for severe disease and death, and the people who care for them and the people who are at most risk and play, you know, critical societal functions such as teachers and first responders and so forth. So that's been sort of the scheme all along. And then we anticipate the time, hopefully within, you know, not too many months, when there'd be a larger number of doses available and we would begin to be vaccinating a broader population through a much larger set of vaccinators, you know, community pharmacies and the like. And then ultimately we get to the point where these vaccines are available just, you know, kind of very broadly, just like other vaccines are, and folks get them at their primary care clinic or at the local pharmacy or in vaccination clinics at their employer. You know, all of that will ultimately be the case. Next slide, please. So our goals for the vaccination effort are these that we've reviewed and the governor's given us direction on these, that we, in order to get to the end of this pandemic as soon as possible, we're gonna need to get the scientists at NIH and CDC tell us we should be striving for 80% of the population to be vaccinated. That's what it will take to really keep transmission under control and to declare the pandemic over. Doesn't mean that COVID's gonna go away, but it would be endemic rather than pandemic at that stage. We will seek to vaccinate our population just as fast as the supply of COVID-19 vaccines will allow. So speed is emerging as a greater and greater priority here, especially with the new variants of SARS-CoV-2 virus that are emerging that appear to be significantly more transmissible. The faster we can get the most people vaccinated, the better. We want to always ensure, and this third one, frankly, is a goal that's just become more clear and more important to us in the last week as the feds have shifted strategy. And again, with the change in administrations, we don't frankly know whether this criterion will be used in future allocation decisions or not. But last week, Wednesday or Thursday, Health and Human Services said, you know, we're looking at changing the way we allocate doses to the states, and we are going to perhaps, or we're thinking about and planning to make part of the allocation decision based on how quickly states are getting through their allocation. So we will reward people who are doing better, and if states aren't getting through their vaccine quickly, that will influence their future allocations. We have not heard from the new administration what their intention is, whether they plan to use a metric like speed or percentage of population vaccinated as a criterion in distribution or not. But the governor's been very clear that we have to be sure, whatever our distribution and prioritization schemes are, that we are not disadvantaging the state by moving too slowly. because that would be a disservice if we don't get, you know, if we don't get as much vaccine as we possibly can from what through whatever the rubric is that sets the priority. We need to work to avoid that as much as we can. We also, though, just knowing that we are going to have limited supply for quite a while, we do need to keep an eye on where can the vaccine do the most good in terms of where's the greatest health impact from a vaccine, kind of back to that idea of who's at greatest risk for severe disease and death, who's in, you know, and who is the most likely to be exposed by virtue of the type of work they do. So that leads you to healthcare workers. And that leads you to certainly where we started with residents of long-term care facilities, other congregate care facilities, where that concentration of housing makes spread a whole lot more rapid. But it also is what's led, you know, pretty clearly emerging consensus just in the last week or so that the over 65 population, which is where the great majority of hospitalizations and deaths are nationally and true here in Minnesota as well, that prioritizing the over 65 population makes a lot of sense in terms of immediate health impact. We do also want to keep a clear eye on understanding that the burden, particularly the burden of exposure, severity of disease and outcome does fall differentially, inequitably, on certain populations by virtue of the type of work they do, the housing conditions, barriers to access to care. We just know that we have to be mindful of those equity considerations in the way we set the allocation to begin with, then the way the distribution system works, and the way that decisions are made at the point of the vaccinating providers as well, that we want to make sure we're tracking and making sure that the populations who are the hardest hit are being reached with vaccination. Next slide, please. So the vaccinator ecosystem that we talk about, there are two slides here that speak to the roles that a whole bunch of different parties play. So in the first phase, when we've been focusing on healthcare workers and long-term care residents and staff, the primary vaccinators by far have been the hospitals and the federal pharmacy partnership that has been vaccinating skilled nursing facilities and assisted living. So that's been logical that they're the, you know, kind of the bulk of the vaccination has happened through those facility-based or worksite-based vaccinators. As we go forward, primary care clinics certainly have a large role to play with their ability to identify their patient population, reach out to them, schedule them, just all of the, you know, the patient relationships and medical records that are in place. They vaccinate all the time as a part of their regular practice. So obviously primary care clinics will have a significant role as we expand into patient populations. We wanted to call out here specifically community clinics, federally qualified health centers, and other community clinics who are embedded deeply in the community, who tend to have more specialized patient population focus, and who's functioning, whose model really approximates, you know, a blend of urgent care with kind of more the more typical you know, scheduling model of primary care clinics. So but the main thing about community clinics is really their, you know, their grounding in some of the very communities that we need to focus on in terms of health impact from COVID. And then of course, pharmacies. Pharmacies play a large role in vaccination and many people, particularly people who may not have a strong primary care relationship or a healthcare home, use their pharmacies and their pharmacists for a wide variety of health consultation purposes. So pharmacies definitely play a role in the vaccine ecosystem. Next one, next slide, please. And then there's local public health, which again, historically plays a large role in vaccination and is able, it has strong community connections. They know the employer community, they know congregate care settings, they know their schools. They work with these partners on vaccination campaigns all the time. They have vaccine infrastructure in place and they have the ability to stand up vaccination clinics, either what are referred to as closed point of dispensing, where it's, you know, aimed at a specific population and it's restricted to that population and to appointments, versus open dispensing, you know, kind of drive-in walk-through clinics open to all, come, you know, come on the day and stand in line and be vaccinated, that they can do both of those models. Wanted to call out here that the tribal nations have kind of their own systems and their own plans and their own sovereignty to determine how best to serve the enrolled members of the tribes, the people living on reservation, the employees of the tribe, and they've got their own vaccine infrastructure in place too. And each nation was able to choose to get vaccine from either from the Indian Health Service or as part of the state of Minnesota's allocation. And they get a population-based share of the vaccine that is given to them, and they have the ability to direct how that is distributed. And then there's the state, which I mentioned our primary role of sort of oversight and planning and sizing populations and so forth, given the epidemiology of the disease. But as a vaccinator, the state also has resources and infrastructure, as we have developed on the testing side, you know, some of that same ability to kind of marshal resources and stand up barrier-free sites, temporary or semi-permanent, and to coordinate with local public health and other partners to get those sites staffed to stand up clinics to kind of complement and supplement the rest of the infrastructure. As well, certainly, the state has state-run facilities, as you know, and we are responsible for vaccinating those and for vaccinating our own workforce when we get to that point. So that's just kind of a quick picture that it's that all of the above are part of administering vaccine and will be as the vaccine supply expands. And this just tries to capture kind of the role of each. We're going to talk a little bit about these pilot sites that are just being stood up this week, but I just really wanted to emphasize the point that that is one part of a broader infrastructure that is intended to complement and supplement these other longstanding roles of healthcare delivery and local public health and pharmacies in delivering vaccine. Next slide, please. So one thing I wanted to clarify is like how this process works in terms of how we order vaccine and when it actually gets to the point when shots can be delivered, and then when we know about it in terms of reports coming back into our system that indeed the shots have been delivered. So just to, hopefully the graphic is, there's a lot on this slide, I hope you can see it, but it, when you look at it, it's fairly self-explanatory, I think. Every Tuesday, usually Tuesday night, we get a number from the CDC, and they say, okay, Minnesota, next week you are getting 65,000 doses of vaccine, you know, 32,000 Moderna and 33,000 Pfizer. That's your number. And then we cannot start actually ordering against that allocation until Thursday. So between Tuesday night and Thursday, we figure out where should next week's allocations go. Based on, you know, where the populations are, what progress we're making. You know, when we've been in this 1A phase, we look region by region at how many healthcare workers remain to be vaccinated and the like. So the ordering happens on Thursday, and then the actual shipping, so the federal government or the manufacturer ships the vaccine that we order. And when we place the order, we literally are saying, send one box of Pfizer to XYZ hospital. Again, it's not coming through MDH. We are ordering for the providers and it's sent directly to them. But then the manufacturer starts shipping at the earliest on Sunday. But it could be, and it comes often doesn't come all at one time. So the manufacturer ships out to the provider sites you know, anytime between Sunday and the following Friday is when it actually arrives at the point where the provider can use it to vaccinate people. But the minute on Tuesday when CDC says you're getting 65,000 doses, it shows up in the numbers that have been allocated to Minnesota. But the providers may not even have a chance of getting it into people's arms, you know, for a good, you know, a good week after that, that allocation number is set. And then, so the shipping goes out, you know, to the designated providers. And in these first phases with the, again, with the complexity of Pfizer, we've used 25 hub locations to be the receivers of most of the Pfizer. And they then in turn redistributed out to smaller hospitals and clinics in a spoke system. So we've been using a hub and spoke system to get the vaccine out to where it needs to go and preserve all those special handling, storage and handling requirements. So then once the person who's going to do, or the site that's going to actually do the vaccination gets the doses and gives the shot, then they have, you know, they're supposed to give us back the data within 24 hours. Sometimes it takes a little longer than that, but they'll give the shot and then they'll report it to the health department. And then the health department has a process of, you know, kind of cleaning and verifying and deduplicating the data. So it's another couple of days before those data are reported on the public website. So that's just to, you know, just to kind of contrast the, you know, the timelines here with what I'm sure many people are, you know, are now used to in our daily life, where we order something and we expect it to show up on the doorstep the next day. And this is not that. So just to be fair to our vaccinating providers, you know, when they actually have the vaccine, that's really the point in time when we want to start the clock, so to speak, and say, now it's our goal to get all vaccines administered to people within 72 hours of the point where it's actually available to the providers to vaccinate. And as a state, the governor has said, we will use all of our vaccine every week. It's our goal when the vaccine comes to Minnesota, we want to make sure every dose of it is used that week. We don't want, you know, wherever there are delays in actually getting it to people, we need to try to close those gaps wherever possible. Next slide, please. So this is the hub and spoke model that I just was speaking of. And this is kind of what we've been using for this first month as we've been working through these more site-based vaccinated populations. So this will be evolving and we'll be doing more shipping directly to a larger group of vaccinators as we spread out here. But this is how the hub and spoke model has looked for the first month. Next slide, please. We've want to make sure though too that we talk about the long-term care facility vaccinations that are happening. So phase 1A, you know, we've had these two main branches, healthcare workers, and then the second branch of phase 1A was long-term care residents and staff. And for that long-term care branch, the federal government set up contracts at the federal level with large national chains to do the vaccinating in long-term care. Now, each long-term care facility actually has the choice to participate in the federal program or not. The majority of our facilities in Minnesota did choose to participate in the federal pharmacy partnership program, which means that the CDC then tells us, okay, Minnesota, of your doses, you have to set half of the Moderna aside every week to give to CVS and Walgreens and Thrifty White to do the long-term care vaccinating. And that is a contract directly between the federal government and those chains. The state doesn't really have a role either in that allocation or in the tracking. But you know, we are reliant on the federal government to give us the data on what's happening, or those chains themselves, or to survey the long-term care providers, because they're just not part of the same distribution system, just to clarify that. So a big chunk of the Minnesota allocation actually is set aside I think it's 150 some thousand doses are set aside for this program. So that just to clarify, I don't know if that further confuses or clarifies that part of the weekly allocation is actually not under the state's supervision or control. Next slide, please. So just a quick status report there on the long-term care side. Things are picking up. The chains have told us, and I think actually the governor's on a call right now, I believe, with at least one of the chains just checking in on their progress. And we've been told that all of the skilled nursing facilities, all 369 of them, those that participated in the federal program and the relatively few that didn't go into that program that are being vaccinated by local public health and local pharmacies, all the skilled nursing facilities have had their first doses delivered. And the allocation that we've received or that the national chains have received is sufficient for the second doses in all the skilled nursing facilities. So that's a way of saying we've got what we need to complete skilled nursing facilities, and we're on pace to get that done. The first doses are complete, and second doses should all be complete by the end of the month or very early into the next month. And that's both staff and residents. Moving on to assisted living, go back one, please. So moving on to assisted living in, they just started vaccinating last week in assisted living facilities, a much larger universe of number of facilities and staff and residents, just given the size of that provider group in Minnesota. And there too, those national chains are projecting that they will meet their federal obligation to complete their assigned responsibilities within 3 to 4 weeks. So first dose and second dose delivered within a month to that whole population. So from what we know, both of those streams are on pace to hit their expected deliverables by being complete with those populations, and that the allocations that have been made for them are sufficient to accomplish that goal.
And Commissioner, could you just mention, or maybe you're going to mention, what happens with the long-term care facilities that do not opt into this federal program?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. For those, and I'll have to get back to you on a percentage there. The great majority of skilled nursing facilities did participate in the federal program. I don't have at my fingertips what percentage of assisted living are in the federal program versus not in the federal program. If they're not in the federal program, then we as a state have the responsibility for matching them up with a local vaccinator, which is a combination of local public health and local community pharmacies. But we did complete the matching of each assisted living facility with their vaccinator. Next slide, please. So on the other branch of 1A, the healthcare workers, and here we are getting data back from each of the 8 regional healthcare coalitions around the state who've been really our kind of a lead in collecting the data about the healthcare workforce, tracking completion rates, and making the allocation decisions each week based on how people are doing getting through these populations. So what we know through the healthcare coalitions, and I will just say there is variability among the regions. Some regions were able to get through priority one and priority two more quickly than others. Priority one was the hospital-based workers who are the most directly in the line of COVID care. So emergency rooms, COVID units, ICUs. So that the workers, hospital workers doing that care were in the first wave, along with emergency medical services, EMS workers. The second wave was sort of an expanded set of acute care workers. And then the third wave is really all other healthcare workers getting more into ambulatory care, and other provider types, home health and others and the like. So priority one and two, wave one and two are substantially complete. Again, we're talking first doses, and some have had their second doses. The priority three is in progress, the healthcare workers, again, are largely being served by the healthcare provider systems and local public health, also filling in some of the gaps for vaccination of healthcare workers.
So, Commissioner, I'm seeing a couple of hands up, and I'd like to give those two members a chance to ask a question. Oh, now I see three of them. What I'd like to do, though, members, I know the commissioner, or I was told the commissioner has a hard stop at 4. Is that still true, Commissioner?
Just a little beyond that, Madam Chair.
Okay. And we do have Chris Erisman with us as well. So I think what I'd like to do is I'll take the members who already have their hands up, but then I'd like to let the commissioner get through her presentation if we can, and then but if you have technical questions, you know, please continue to ask those. So I think we've got Representative Pryor and then Freiberg and Schultz. Representative Pryor.
I can wait till the end. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Leakey.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. We'll keep you on the list. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This relates to actually the slide that's up there right now. You mentioned that home care workers are included in the third level of priority. That is one group I've heard a bit from. I just imagine, you know, without large employers or common work sites, it's a little harder for them to prove that they work in a home care setting. I'm just wondering what sorts of systems you have in place to ensure that they are getting the vaccines that they're entitled to.
Commissioner?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Freiberg. We've been there again. The healthcare coalitions have been playing a role in trying to identify the workforce in their regions and helping to try to coordinate among the healthcare providers who are doing the vaccinating with those workers. And again, local public health is doing some gap filling there as well. So we're that's really a focus in the coming, you know, couple of weeks to be communicating with those particular sectors, as you say, that we know are perhaps less automatically connected to sources of vaccination, to help them get connected if they haven't yet been.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Schultz.
You can put me on the list for after the presentation.
Okay, fantastic. Okay, thank you. Okay, Commissioner, please go ahead. And members, go ahead and put your hand down. Actually, I think we're having a little technical difficulty with that. So go ahead, Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So moving on. So wanted to talk a little bit about the pilot program that the governor announced just 2 days ago, and is those clinics are going to begin operating tomorrow. And again, kind of back to that ecosystem point, that this is one part of the broader strategy to start vaccinating people in two groups: adults age 65 and older, who also, you know, can get served by their healthcare provider to the extent the healthcare provider has doses available, which, as we've talked about, is very short supply right now, and also. Educators and childcare workers. The nine sites have two distinctly different processes for adults age 65 and older, where that is a public sign-up process, where folks are going onto the website or calling the call center to make appointments. In both of these cases, these are appointment only, no walk-ups, but folks over 65 are seeking appointments through a public sign-up process, and educators and childcare workers are working with their employer, so the school district or the childcare center, to get access to slots that are reserved for those populations. So two different ways of signing up. Each of the nine sites, the number of doses are split 50-50 between those two groups. So 50% through that public sign-up process for 65 and older, and 50% made available for this closed sign-up process through school districts and childcare centers. And this is really a pilot. As we did with community testing, tried it out and refined the model and got better at doing it. As we learned, I think the governor felt strongly that even though we don't have very many doses right now, we needed to kind of build this, test it, and be ready, just as we are working with all the other parts of the ecosystem to kind of build up their capacity and be ready to take more doses when more doses come. That was the goal here, that these learning how this works would give us a foundation for being able to do more of, kind of community-based mass vaccination clinics to supplement what the providers can do. And that's certainly we can, I'm sure you may have questions about the pilot that we can get to in your questions. Next slide, please. Just a quick update, the signups started yesterday, and as expected, it was instantaneous demand that was way in excess of what was available. That was a certainly expected problem. We had over 1 million website hits, and the call center was, very, very heavily used. I know people were on hold for a long time. In many cases, and they're just a huge pent-up demand. But the systems, both of them, both the web and the phone system, are designed to tell people, when the appointments are full and the wait list is full, there's no point to keep on trying to, to call or to log on. So that happened within a couple of hours of those two entry points being opened up. So there will be next week's appointment will be opened up at noon next Tuesday. And again, that's for the public over 65 option, and the educators and childcare workers get notified by their employer whether they some of those slots are available to them. So it was a tremendous response. The 6,000 appointments were filled, quite quickly. And I think there's a wait list of 11,000 for those sites. So we are appreciative of Minnesotans' patience. We know it can be frustrating, but you're helping us to learn and to improve the system. Next slide, please. So some of what we've learned as we've gone through phase 1A, and certainly we'll learn a lot operationally through these pilot sites as well. The doses are allocated based on the eligible population, but we know, in the case of healthcare workers and long-term care residents, the experience of the last few weeks is that folks choose when they want to get vaccinated. And they choose whether they want to get vaccinated. And so that leads to, some providers having been allocated a supply and they don't get as many takers, and then they've got extra, and others having more take up and the doses don't go as far. It's part of what leads to that regional variability. We also suggested, as CDC did and we did as well, that for instance, a hospital or a clinic would stagger their doses. So if they wouldn't want all the healthcare workers in a certain unit to have been vaccinated on the same day, so that they are, potentially having some vaccine reactions that make them not feeling all that well all at the same time for a day or so after the shot. So just complexities in the scheduling and the administration. We've talked about the federal program and the fact that we don't have much oversight or insight into it. This uncertainty of the supply, the changing, there are extra doses, no, there aren't, go ahead and make your plans to expand, oh, nope, there's no more doses. That shifting scene has been a major major challenge, and the fact that the federal government pretty much preempted the discussion of prioritization last Tuesday by saying, federally saying, all people 65 and over are now eligible, which led to a huge huge demand, obviously, that we weren't in a great position to be able to fulfill. And I think, the last point is just continuing to learn about vaccine hesitancy. How much is there? What is the uptake rate? What are the reasons why people are perhaps reluctant to get the vaccine? And what can we do to continue to provide the best information to help people make the best choices? Next slide, please. I think I hope we're getting close to the end here. I think we've got a couple more vaccine coming. We will see what the story is from the new administration in terms of whether and to what extent Pfizer and Moderna production can be ramped up and more doses purchased for the United States, and how to get that out to the states more quickly, that we await that. We also know that Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca and their partners are in the process and nearing the part of the process where we might expect federal FDA action on emergency use authorization as soon as February, in the case of Johnson & Johnson, and possibly a little later for AstraZeneca, which would, so our projections of, the 60 to 70,000 dose a week level is what we're getting today, what we've been told to expect for the foreseeable future. That will change if more Pfizer and Moderna can be procured, and as J&J and AstraZeneca come online. And is there another? Yeah, I think we're going to skip through these, Madam Chair. This is just the what I've just flashed by. There are the public dashboard. Members hopefully have perused that or can at your leisure. I will just say, I think the dashboard's been up for a little over a week, and we're already working on version 2.0 to try to make it more clear and more accessible for Minnesotans. But the goal there is it's interactive. You can look at the county level. You can look at a fair amount of detail, as well as having access to the underlying data. But just to, again, put a fine point on the mismatch between supply and demand. We've talked before about the fact that in Tier 1A, there are approximately 500,000 Minnesotans that we believe we will have reached all of them, at least, and offered them the opportunity to be vaccinated by the end of this month. But 65 plus now is, that's over 900,000 Minnesotans. And that's a lot of people who, at our current pace, that would take us about 4 months to get through even the over 65 population. So it's a definite challenge. We're building the system to be able to, and the commitment is we've got to be able to get this vaccine, out quickly, out safely, maximizing the impact that the vaccines have, whether we're getting 65,000 doses a week or 500,000 doses a week. We've got to be able to administer as much as we can get. So that's our commitment. I think that's it, Madam Chair.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Commissioner. That's a lot of information. We have quite a few members with questions. So I'm just going to tell everybody who we've got on the list here so that you can kind of keep track. So I've got, it'll be Pryor, Schultz, Grunhagen, Quam, Ackland, Ryer, Freiberg, Bolden. So you don't have to memorize it, but just to give folks a sense. Okay, let's start with Representative Pryor. Thank you for being patient with us.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So the question I have for the commissioner, and maybe it's something for the next discussion too, which is, personal situation, my in-laws live in assisted living, and they were vaccinated for the first time next week. A few weeks from now, they'll get their second dose. So somebody in that age group of 65 plus, 80 plus, once they're vaccinated, What's the public health recommendation for, you know, basically how they can keep themselves safe, continue to be safe? And also, you know, we know that you could be vaccinated, and I think the potential is that you could still, it might have a mild case of COVID, which would you spread it to somebody else? So is there now an understanding? And then even within households, if you're a provider, you might be, you know, a household where two people in their 60s, one of them is vaccinated. This is just a hypothetical. wouldn't have anything to do with my household, but the other person is not. And so then how do you, you know, how do you, this kind of, this, we're going to, until everybody, until we hit that 80%, you know, how do we start understanding, or how should we start thinking about vaccinated versus not vaccinated?
Madam Chair and Representative Pryor, thanks. What we don't know yet is what impact the vaccine has on the risk of transmission. And the clinical studies were really only about, does the vaccine prevent clinical disease? So somebody could be infected, but the vaccine helps them from having a severe reaction to the infection. And it's 95% effective for that. It's reasonable to think that the vaccine probably also protects against the ability to transmit the virus just based on the biology of it, but we don't have data to that effect yet. So that's the reason why the recommendation is, even after vaccination, you should not assume that you are not a transmission risk to somebody else. So we still recommend, you know, that those other precautions are important, masking and distancing, even post-vaccination, until we get to the, you know, to the point where we either have clear data about the impact of the vaccine on transmissibility, which should be a matter of months. It's not going to be years before we know that. And until we get to, you know, higher percentages of the population being vaccinated.
Madam Chair, if I can just make one comment, which is just, you know, I don't know if we say it enough, but how grateful we are for the work and how reassuring it is to hear these presentations. And I hope that I can convey this sense of, you know, of this, we're firmly on the right path and moving forward with this. And I hope I can convey that to my constituents as clearly and as confidently as you have. And thank you for everything that you and the team are doing.
Thank you so much.
Representative Grunhagen is next on the list.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, thanks for your presentation, Commissioner. I've been contacted by a few elderly, especially who aren't in a nursing home or assisted living, who want the vaccination. And I've told them to call their local clinic or hospital to see what's available, but you're saying they should probably go to this website, correct?
Madam Chair and Representative Grunhagen, I think it's sort of a both and. I mean, what we've said is the vaccine supply is so limited right now that we know that most clinics don't yet have enough doses to do anything more than their healthcare worker population yet. That will change week as more of the vaccine is available for the over 65 population. But what we've sort of said to folks is, you know, don't flood your clinic with calls, because they know you're there. They know you're their patient. They will call you when they've got vaccine available, but they will be coming. But an option in the meantime, even though it's a very limited option, which we recognize, is to, you know, if one of those pilot sites is convenient for them, that they could try to get an appointment there. But just realistically, we know that there are that's not intended to serve the majority of the population.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Representative Schultz, you had a question?
Thank you. Yes, Commissioner, I want to add to my thanks for everything you and your team have been doing during this whole pandemic. I just have two questions. My first is, in the closed loop system for educators and staff, are we only relying on our public school districts? And what about educators and staff at private schools? How are they getting vaccinated? And I know many of them are using face-to-face right now. classes? And my second question is, when people call in for an appointment, those 65 and plus, are we prioritizing individuals at all in that system?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Schultz, the education slots are available to public schools, charter schools, and private schools. But again, just in full transparency, there's a very limited pilot at this point in time. But and we are working. The Department of Education is working with school districts and with those the private schools and charters to make slots available to them, which they then decide, you know, how to prioritize and how to offer those slots to specific staff on the education side. On the 65 and over slot side, in these community pilot sites, that's the only criterion. There is not further sub-prioritization. I know that healthcare, you know, the provider organizations are thinking about, how to reach out to their 65 and older population and whether and how to, you know, kind of prioritize within that very large group based on any other criteria. But from our perspective, the criteria is just 65 and older.
Thank you, Commissioner.
You're muted, Mr. Chair.
Am I unmuted now? Sorry, I'm in a panic here. Sorry, Commissioner. It looks like Representative Quam is next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. Looking at the stock that we have that we haven't used yet, even if we went up to 80,000 doses per week and we're shipped 65,000 and that froze, it would take us 24 weeks to work through our back stock. So I'm very interested in seeing what the ramp up of inoculations would be, because, you know, we've heard of instances where they haven't used them, and, you know, they've, like New York has had situations where they've had to dispose of it. But if we got 24 weeks to burn through, even with the only getting 65K per week, it just seems like we really need to almost double or triple the rate at which we're vaccinating.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Quam, thanks for asking that, because it allows me to just get a little more clear about the data. And that, as I mentioned, we're kind of improving the dashboard to be more clear about this. But if you break down, how many doses, and again, there's a difference between when the feds say we've allocated, 600,000 doses to Minnesota. First, you have to take off the top the 150,000 or so that have been reserved for that federal program. Then you got to say how many doses have actually been shipped and how many doses have been received by the providers. And then it's also good to know how many of those doses are reserved for the second dose, so they're not supposed to be being given right now. And then further on top of that, of all those doses that the providers have, how many of them just got there like the day before and you wouldn't have expected them to be administered yet. So we're trying to get a more granular picture of when doses arrive and how long it takes to get those doses, delivered to folks. But it's very, when you look at the big numbers, it looks like we're not moving very fast. When you do all that math that I just took you through, the doses that are actually available to deliver, the percentage of completion on those is way higher than what you're seeing. So we've kind of got a problem of that. The data is the reportable data is telling a story that's not fully accurate, and we're just trying to make that a little clearer picture, because we're actually, our providers have really picked up the pace and done a really good job of getting faster at administering these doses once they actually get them, and the ones that they don't have to save for second doses. That whole second dose thing is another complication in the whole process.
Mr. Chair, I thought earlier I heard that I guess we're expecting that the feds had a reserve for the second dosage, and there wasn't any reserve second dosage. Now we're being told that actually the reserve for the second dosage is staged within our state. It'd be nice to actually have the numbers clearly presented, because it looked as if we plateaued below 80,000 vaccinations per week. We went up to 77,000, dropped down to under 72,000. Because getting 65, if we stay at 80 or less, we're only burning through 15K of the back. And even if you have a 50% reduction, you know, that's held in reserve, you're still talking at least a month to 2 months before we would burn through that the stuff that's there. And so, you know, again, it'd be nice to see the plan and the expected increase in rate of vaccination, because I know several states are vaccinating quite a bit higher levels than we are, as in percent of received to administered, including neighboring states of ours. So that's the kind of plan that would help give confidence that we are going to get stuff out, because if I was the feds, I would probably give increased supply to the ones that are actually using a higher utilization of what's delivered. And whether the number is misleading, that it's lower than what in actuality it should be, it's still behind where we ought to be. I want Minnesota to be saying we're doing a great job of administering and getting it out to people, and that's why we need more. I think that's much, much better message for the feds. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Quam, and we'll work on that. Commissioner, unless you have a statement there, we're going to move on.
Yeah, just real quickly, Mr. Chairman, Representative Quam, we certainly agree with you. It is important to be timely with everything we've got, and that just to clarify what the feds had said was they had a separate reserve for above and beyond the second doses that were actually needed at any given time, and that's what they said last week. No, we don't. That any extra reserve. There isn't one. So what we have to manage the second doses in addition to the first doses. And I realize that's the numbers get very confusing. Your point's well taken. We need to be clear about what numbers mean what, and then we need to be timely. So completely agree with you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Eklund.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner Malcolm, thank you. My larger question had been answered, and that was regarding the messaging that people are requesting about when am I considered immune. I think that's been answered fairly well. I had a small second question, and that was, is it absolutely essential that the second dose be from the same manufacturer as the first dose?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eklund, yes, that is an important consideration. The you have to get the second dose manufactured that you got the first dose, and the timing is important. So keeping track of those second dose appointments is really important.
Thank you.
All right. I hope everyone can hear me. Sorry, in this virtual age, apparently there's a big internet outage here in Rochester. So I am now on my phone. So I hope you can all hear me. I think that next on the list we have Representative Breyer.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, did you say Ryer or Freiberg?
I said Ryer.
Okay, then. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Commissioner Malcolm, and your team. I'll echo my colleagues in my appreciation for all that you do. I have a question about, you know, there are two things. One of the bottlenecks is availability of vaccine, and the other is the amount of time it takes to get from point A to point B. And I found that to be a most revealing slide about the number of sheer days. So my questions are, now that we have the Biden administration in place, are you anticipating that he'll be using the Defense Production Act to accelerate dramatically the pace of production? And if so, can the manufacturers handle that to make any type of material difference? And secondly, you know, the process engineer in, at the heart of me says, is there somebody working on that many, many day process? Because you look at what retailers can do now from the time you order to deliver. And it seems to me that there should be something that could be thought through in a better way. And so I just wanted to put a voice in for that. So thank you.
Madam Chair and Representative Ryer, thanks. Yes, we are certainly looking forward to some additional discussion with the federal government about how to process engineer the delivery system, perhaps differently, though that is really not anything that we can control, how feds are interacting with the manufacturers and they with us. We should be held accountable for how quickly do we get it to the providers and how quickly they get it into people's arms, you know, once it's here. In terms of the Defense Production Act, we have heard that that is intended, and that we think it's good that former FDA Commissioner David Kessler has kind of been put in charge of working directly with the manufacturers to just understand what has been not clear to us is what is the ramp up capacity for the first two vaccines and then the others when they come on. So we're certainly hopeful, but we just have absolutely no projections yet about what that might mean or how quickly.
Follow up, Representative Ryer.
Just a quick one. What is your level of confidence, Commissioner, that should this ramp up dramatically, that you have the plans in place and the capacity within the state to do our part from receipt to into the air?
Commissioner.
And Representative Ryer, that's exactly what we're trying to do now, is build a system that is capable of scaling up quickly. You know, and if we were to say, well, we've only got 65,000 doses a week now, and our current distribution system is perfectly able to handle that, we don't want to wait until, oh my gosh, we could have, 200,000 next week. We don't want to wait till then to know how we would deliver that larger number. So those plans are underway right now with our healthcare systems are figuring out how they could, increase their current capacity, their regular, if you will, immunization capacity. When you add up the all those different parts of the ecosystem that I talked about earlier, we, in the flu season, we have the capacity to do 500,000 a week. So if everybody is operating at full capacity, so that's, this is a little bit more complicated vaccine than that, but we definitely are trying to scale for that level of activity.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner, for that. So I now have Representative Freiberg, then Bolden, then Keel. Representative Freiberg.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thanks again, Commissioner. I do appreciate the work everyone at MDH is doing to get these vaccines into arms as quickly as possible. You know, I know demand is outstripping supply dramatically in the 65 plus age group. Appreciate what you said, that the pilot project will enable us to be ready when we do have more supply. I'm just wondering if there's anything we can do to improve efficiency at this stage. I mean, I heard from some people in my area who waited online for 3 hours just before kind of giving up. So, just wondering if you're looking at ways just to, cut people off of waiting, if you've already scheduled as many appointments as there are vaccines or anything along those lines.
Commissioner.
And Representative Freiberg. Yeah, I think that lots of lessons are being harvested already from yesterday. From yesterday's sign-up experience, I know that Minnesota IT Commissioner Tomes is kind of in the lead on that, about how do we improve the technology. It is supposed to do that, and not have people waiting online, either on the phone or on the web. When the slots are gone, there's supposed to be like an immediate message to that effect, so that people don't have that experience. So yes, they will be trying to, you know, problem solve and improve the process so that next week's version of this, you know, goes a little bit smoother. But just that mismatch between the number of people who are eager to see if they could possibly get one of those relatively few slots is just that it speaks to the, you know, the eagerness that's out there on the part of a lot of folks to get vaccinated, which is good. We are sorry for the frustration that we can't do it tomorrow.
Thank you.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. You know, it's a good moment to just thank Minnesotans who are exhibiting an enormous amount of patience and just to appreciate how frustrating this is for so many folks. And I know everyone, you know, this should have been long over. And it's hopefully we're getting closer to the end. Representative Bolden and then Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Malcolm. Again, I will just echo that of my colleagues. Thanks to you and all the work that you're doing and for your time here today. My question is, do we know the percentage of healthcare workers who are declining or opting out of vaccination?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Representative Bolden, we don't have hard data on that yet. We've got some anecdotal reports from vaccinating partners, and that it varies a lot by setting. In the long-term care facilities, we're kind of concerned by the relatively low take-up rate on the part of workers, really high take-up rate among residents. That's great. And in acute care settings, the percentages have been, you know, kind of widely dispersed from system to system. But we have also heard from some of the folks that as more vaccination is happening and as colleagues see other colleagues having been vaccinated, feeling good about it, that they're believing that that those numbers will continue to increase, that just somebody passing it up on the first opportunity doesn't mean they never will get it. So that's encouraging, but we definitely need to understand more. What are the questions? What are the concerns? So we can speak to those.
Representative Bolden, any follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick one along those same lines. Is there a mechanism that we are collecting that data to get a better understanding of if people are declining, why?
Yeah, we're certainly asking you know, the healthcare systems to sort of try to, you know, survey their workers and understand what that is. I don't know if Chris Ayersman was able to join on the call or not. If she's on, I would invite her to comment on that. And certainly,
Commissioner, she had to leave. Sorry.
Sorry, Lisa.
Okay. Okay.
Commissioner Chris Ayersman had to step off. Sorry.
Okay.
Good to know that. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, thank you for all of your time and work. I gotta imagine sleep is sometimes escapes you from all the stress. But I'm wondering if you were positive over 65. And recently, tested recently, had COVID-19, also had comorbidities, would it be prudent not to be one of those who would seek that vaccine right away, being that they have immunities already from it? It would help people to get the vaccine to those who hadn't had any COVID-19. I hear people like they've got COVID-19 and they're like, oh, I'm going to get that vaccine right away. And I think, but that will help us to help everybody to be more, you know, stretch out that ability of being immune.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair and Representative Keel, that's exactly right. And when we, you know, kind of, want to make sure that people who have had COVID-19 know that, you know, as far as the CDC has advised, that at least for 90 days after recovery that there does seem to be some acquired immunity, and we don't know how much longer than that it lasts, but that people don't really wouldn't need to get vaccinated before at least 90 days after recovery. And that would be, you know, a way, as you say, of, you know, letting our neighbors go first, so to speak, and those of us who, you know, may be eligible but feel like we're at lower risk, you know, thinking that way, you know, about making the vaccine available for those at highest risk, I think is a great, you know, kind of citizenship thing to think about. But definitely, we still want people to get vaccinated eventually, but not a priority within the first 90 days.
Thank you.
Representative Keogh. Madam Chair, thank you. You said something, Commissioner Malcolm, that occurred to me. I have heard anecdotally a couple of stories where someone has not been sick at all. For some reason, they go to be tested, not necessarily, but they're in their clinic or whatever, and their doctor says, oh, by the way, you have you already have antibodies. They're quizzical as to, I don't even know when I got sick or if I ever got sick. And I'm just wondering, so the 90 days that you said, that's what we know, but could it be possible much longer?
Madam Chair and Representative Keel, I think, yep, that's one of the big unanswered questions. We don't know how much antibody is necessary for how much protection or for how long lasting. So all of that are data that are going to be accumulated as time goes on here, as we have more experience. But just the point you made is so important to remember. The very significant, and it's thought to be 40 or 50% of all people who have COVID or have had COVID might be asymptomatic or so mildly symptomatic that you wouldn't know it was COVID if you, you know, kind of were achy one day or had a headache. That, you know, a whole lot of asymptomatic or very mildly symptomatic cases are out there, and that's part of what's made transmission and community spread such a challenge, is when people don't even know they're sick. They're, you know, in a position to infect others without having any idea that they might be doing that, which is, you know, again, kind of why the strong emphasis on doing those basic prevention measures while there is this much virus in our communities, you know, kind of no matter what, just still paying attention to distancing and masking and hand washing, all those good things.
Okay. So I'm not seeing any other questions. We have reached the end of our list. Aha, Representative Morrison, please go ahead. Commissioner, do you have a few minutes that you can
stay? Madam Chair, if you wouldn't mind, if this could be the last one, then I have to run, unfortunately.
Okay, very good. Representative Morrison, last word goes to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner, thank you again for being here. And this is a very quick one, and there's probably not an answer to it, but I'm curious. We obviously are having a turnover of administrations today. Do you have any sense when you might hear from the new administration about their rolling out their new vaccine plan?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Representative Morrison, you know, that there have certainly been some conversations with the transition team, you know, now the team that's in place at HHS. I'm delighted that a couple of top leaders who've been appointed at the assistant secretary level for health are current state health officers, my peers in other states. And so that makes me optimistic that the folks at the federal level might be a little more attuned to the need for a strong partnership with the states. So we're looking forward both to kind of clarity and, you know, kind of frankly a little more coherence of a federal strategy that we hope will be a little more. A little more sensitive to the states. So optimistic on that front.
All right. Well, Commissioner, we certainly appreciate your appearance here today. We know you're so busy, and I I guess I missed some members telling you how much they appreciate your work. I'm going to have to, sorry, members, about my technical issues today. I'm going to go back and listen to some of your questions because I know I missed some good questions and answers. But Commissioner, we so appreciate your work and your appearance today. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, for the time. And thank you, members, for your good questions and your kind words. I most certainly will pass that along to my colleagues who deserve all the credit. So thank you so much.
Very good. And so members are, thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you, Representative Hewitt, Vice Chair Hewitt, for taking over for me. I understand you stepped in very ably. I appreciate that. And so our next meeting is Monday at 1 o'clock. We have this strangely changing time for this committee. So 1 o'clock on Monday, and we will be learning something about our emergency medical system. So looking forward to that. And not seeing any other questions or comments, I think we can end just a very few minutes early here. And unless anybody wants to squeeze in anything before we adjourn, not seeing any comments. Okay, well, members, thank you so much. The committee is adjourned.